Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is now 1:02 p.m. on Wednesday, March 29th, 2017. Before we begin, I would like to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and our aide from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind everyone in the room and on the committee to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Kopp, Representative Reinbold, my Vice Chair, Representative Fansler, and myself, Representative Clayman. We have a quorum to do business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 43, New Drugs for the Terminally Ill, which is sponsored by Representative Gren. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill is Representative Gren. If the bill sponsor would please come forward with his staff and identify yourselves for the record, and then we can begin the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Jason Gren, representing District 22 in Anchorage, Alaska, and I appreciate the opportunity to present this important piece of legislation to you today. Before I get started, I would like to notify members that we do have several individuals with extensive knowledge of this legislation that's been worked across the country, and they will be available for questions during public testimony later in the hearing.
You could just a moment, I recognize that Representative Christ Tompkins has joined us. You can proceed.
So the goal of House Bill 43, or Right to Try, is to create a legal climate in which a terminally ill patient who has exhausted all FDA-approved treatment options may work with their doctor and drug manufacturers to access investigational treatments that have passed Phase 1 of the FDA approval process but are not yet widely available. Right to Try laws have now been passed in 33 states. 15 additional states, including Alaska, are considering the law. Each year, it is estimated that over 1 million Americans die from terminal illness. For those who have exhausted all FDA-approved options, clinical trials become the next step. However, of those patients who attempt to gain entry into the clinical trial, it is found that fewer than 3% are accepted. In recognition that the 97% of patients denied access to clinical trials, the FDA does have a program in place for accessing investigational drugs outside of clinical trials known as the Compassionate Use Program. Nevertheless, it's estimated that only about 1,200 people make it through this arduous federal process each year. Given this information, the goal of HB 43 is to provide the same access as the FDA's existing Compassionate Use Program, but on a shorter timeline. By ensuring terminally ill patients have more timely access to safe but experimental drugs in consultation with their doctor, HB 43 attempts to offer new hope when all FDA-approved options have been exhausted. I will now defer to my staff, Brooke Ivey, to walk members through the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to testify in House Bill 43 today. For the record, my name is Brooke Ivey, staff to Representative Jason Gren. So I have a little PowerPoint here. Most of what's referenced is in your packets as separate documents. But House Bill 43 has four sections, so a sectional analysis is actually included in your packet if you'd like to follow along. Section 1 of the bill prohibits the State Medical Board from taking disciplinary action against physicians for prescribing or administering an investigational drug to a terminally ill patient that meets certain criteria. So patients under this section must be ineligible or unable to participate in an ongoing clinical trial, have considered all other approved treatment options, and have provided written consent. Section 2 of the bill is a new section in AS 0965, which establishes that physicians, medical team members, manufacturers, importers, and distributors who are acting in good faith and with reasonable care will not be held liable in the case of injury or death of a terminally ill patient from the use of the investigational drug, provided that informed consent was obtained from the patient and notice of immunity was also given to the patient in advance. This section also establishes immunity for physicians and manufacturers who choose not to participate in prescribing or distributing investigational drugs. Section 3 adds a new section to AS 172110, statute limiting the sale and distribution of new drugs. The new section will allow physicians to prescribe or administer investigational drugs under the conditions established in Section 1 of the bill. And finally, Section 4 would prevent the Department of Health and Social Services from requiring a licensed healthcare facility to increase its services solely to accommodate physicians who are prescribing or administering investigational drugs to a patient. So as we talk about this bill, it'll probably be helpful for members to be familiar with the different phases of the FDA drug review process. So I'll walk through that briefly. Prior to phase one is when sponsors of a drug are required to submit what's called an investigational new drug or IND application. It's through this application process the FDA reviews the applicant's preclinical testing results and determines whether the drug is reasonably safe for testing in humans. Then we move on to phase one. Phase one studies occur after the approval of the investigational new drug application. These studies may be conducted on healthy volunteers in cases of testing on drugs like ibuprofen or anti-inflammatories, or on individuals with specific diseases or terminal illnesses. The goal of phase one testing is to determine possible side effects and toxicity levels. So basically, phase one focuses on safety. Phase two studies begin when a drug passes phase one and is therefore considered relatively safe, so there's no unaccepted toxicity levels. And so while phase one focuses really on safety, phase two focuses on the drug's effectiveness. If there is evidence a drug is effective, it will then progress to phase three. This is where more information is gained on safety and effectiveness, particularly in varying populations or at different dosages and in combination with other medications. And then finally, after phase three, this is when sponsors of the drug then have a review meeting with the FDA, and they go on to complete what's called a new drug application, where if they're approved, this would allow them to market their drug in the United States. From there, the FDA has 60 days to decide whether to officially file the application for review, and if filed, applications are generally processed within 10 months. So in House Bill 43, when we use the term investigational drugs, we're talking about those drugs that have passed the safety testing in phase one and remain in ongoing clinical trials in phase two or phase three of the FDA approval process. Now, as Representative Gren referenced in his opening, the FDA does have an existing compassionate use program designed for terminally ill patients that don't have access to a clinical trial, that they can still access those investigational treatments outside of the trial. So to start this process, a patient must work with their doctor to apply to the FDA. For years, and by the FDA's own estimate, the application form alone would take an estimated 100 hours for the doctor to complete. So very recently, the FDA has made great efforts to streamline this application process, but this is only the first step in the process. So manufacturers must also submit lengthy documentation. Once that's complete, application paperwork must then make its way through the FDA internal approval process, then go to a separate institutional review board for approval, which is often a lengthy multi-month process. So finally, as mentioned earlier, 33 states have now signed right to try laws, signed the right to try into law, and most states have had overwhelming bipartisan and often unanimous support. And this kind of shows you the map of the current status across the country here. And if I may, before concluding, I'd just like to take a moment to draw members' attention to one document within your packet, just so you know why it was included. It's entitled Clinical Trials. And while HB 43 focuses on terminally ill patients who do not qualify for clinical trials, we felt the inclusion of these Alaskan stories would help illustrate local experiences with terminal illness, as well as the benefit of simply having access to new treatment options, whether in a clinical trial or not in a clinical trial. So just wanted to give you that background. With that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this concludes our prepared testimony. Thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Because rather than go straight to questions for the bill sponsor, we have a number of people who want to testify. So what I'm going to do is go ahead and open the public hearing, and we'll hear public testimony, and then we can certainly ask questions of the bill sponsor when the public testimony is over. So I will now open the public testimony. And I think the first person that we're going to hear from is Jason Norris. And I understand, Representative Grenton, you have a letter from Mr. Norris?
Correct, Mr. Chair. I'll be reading Jason Norris's written testimony.
Is he available online as well?
He is not, that's why I'm reading.
Okay, I'm just trying to make it clear. Okay, go ahead, Representative Grenton. This is with regard to Jason Norris.
Thank you. I write to you today in support of HB 43 with the short title, New Drugs for the Terminally Ill. I understand that your time is limited, and therefore I'll be in an effort to be as brief as possible. In June of 2011, my father was diagnosed with ALS, sometimes known as Lou Gehrig's disease. For those unfamiliar, this disease slowly saps a person's ability to move, rendering them bedridden. Eventually, it takes away their ability to breathe, at which point they die. It should be noted that this disease does not affect a person's mind. Therefore, they are acutely aware of their daily deterioration, and because of this, the mind becomes a prisoner within the body. For my father, this began in June with a reduced range of motion in his left leg. At this point, he had been working 12-hour days, 5 to 6 days a week per week as a machinist. I feel this is important to point out because of the extended hours and physical nature of the job. He was, by all accounts, a very strong and healthy man at the time of diagnosis. But by late fall, he had completely lost his ability to walk. And at Thanksgiving, he held our 5-month-old son in the last time in his arms as he became too weak to trust him with such precious cargo. When he finally lost all movement in his limbs, he would hug our children by nuzzling his face against them. As we entered into the depths of winter, he and I carried on what conversations we could, trying to accelerate what should have been more years of passing knowledge and wisdom from father to son. These conversations became increasingly difficult as the disease made his breathing quite labored, even with the assistance of a BiPAP machine. While the painful and emotional moments are too many to list, the most painful came when I asked him a simple question. Dad, are you angry? He responded with uncommon grace and humility by uttering one word with every labored breath. I'm not angry. I'm just sad that I won't see your kids grow up. And in the early mornings of February 1st, 2012, he died at the all-too young age of 58. My father was a good man and my hero. He was a tireless worker and a great role model and an unparalleled family man. He took a chance on Alaska in 1996 when he moved his family from the only home he had ever known to a place that we had no connections, no network, no family, and no friends. The gamble paid off for all of us. He saw the potential in this state. He fought like we all do to make a life here. And in the end, I wish the state had afforded him the right to fight this disease with the same ferocity. Recently in the Washington Post, there was an article detailing the experience of a man who had, for all intents and purposes, beaten ALS through advanced therapies pioneered by doctors at the ALS Center in Atlanta, Georgia. In reading about this man, I became aware of the Right to Try movement. Soon, therefore, I became aware of the bill that which I write to you in support of today. I implore you to pass this bill and encourage your colleagues in the Senate to do the same. I cannot say that these advanced therapies would have helped save my father's life, but they may yet save someone else's father, mother, daughter, or son. Thank you for your consideration on this important legislation.
And I would note that Representative Ledoux has joined us. Next is Dr. Del Pessin from XL Diagnostics in Texas. Dr. Del Pessin, are you on the line? No, he's not. Okay. Next on the list, I have Elizabeth Crome from Wasilla. Ms. Crome, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
If you can state your name for the record, any affiliation you may have, and then you can proceed with your testimony because we have a number of folks who are trying to keep it to approximately 2 minutes.
Not a problem. My name is Elizabeth Crome. I am calling from Wasilla, Alaska to support HB 43. I have been a licensed nurse in Alaska since 1979, and I've practiced in a hospital setting for 30 years. I believe that hope is one thing all humans require. For some, once they have been diagnosed with a terminal condition, it is the hope of a peaceful death at home. For others, it is the hope to live to see the birth of a grandchild or a child graduating from high school. But that hope is so important to individuals. And the right to try an a treatment that may or may not prolong a life is the right to continue to hope. And I would love to see our state give individuals that right to give them hope for the next stage of their life, no matter what it might be. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Crome. Next, we have Michael Mahari from the National Communications Director for the 10th Amendment Center. Mr. Mahari, are you online?
I am. Good afternoon, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak very briefly to the committee in support of HB 43. I am the National Communications Director for the 10th Amendment Center. My name is Mike Mahari, and we've been involved supporting this legislation across the United States pretty much since the beginning. We actually call this our no-brainer issue because it's just really difficult to oppose it, and I think some of the testimony you've already heard attest to that. That's why this type of legislation is already passed by huge margins in 33 states. Laws and regulations are supposed to protect people, but unfortunately by their nature, regulatory schemes also tend to create bureaucracy and red tape that can cause harm. And even if the FDA expanded use program meets the needs of some patients, it doesn't even begin to address the black hole between the end of clinical trials and the final approval of treatment. This process can take up to 10 months, and that leaves patients in limbo. Between the end of clinical trials and final approval, they really don't have any alternatives. And this was the situation that more than 70 cancer patients in Texas found themselves in. And I believe the doctor there is scheduled to testify. I'm not sure if he's able to call in or not. But this doctor had begun clinical trials. He had found a very successful treatment for a specific type of cancer. It was actually the type of cancer that Steve Jobs had. And it got to the end of the clinical trials, and they still hadn't given final approval to the drug. And FDA basically told him he had to stop treating his patients. But he was able to step in and re-begin treating them under the new state law that was passed in Texas, the Texas Right to Try. So, in fact, it was so successful in the state of Texas, the legislature is now considering a bill to expand the program to not only include terminally ill but also chronically ill patients. So this type of legislation illustrates the beauty of our federated structure. The American system was never intended to run based on a one-size-fits-all solutions imposed from Washington, D.C.
Mr. Mahari, you're at about 2 minutes. If you could conclude your remarks, that would be great.
Well, I'm just in concluding, Right to Try is a specific example of states using their rightful authority to exercise control over local issues. So if Right to Try helps even one Alaskan patient, I think it's worth putting this legislation on the books. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak and encourage your support of HB 43.
Thank you very much. Next we have Ken Landfield from Homer. Mr. Landfield, can you hear us?
I can indeed.
If you go ahead and state your name and any affiliation.
My name is Ken Landfield, and I am not affiliated with, anyone. Some things are hard, like health care and finances. Some things, it seems to me, are not so hard, and as the previous gentleman testifying suggested, no-brainer might be an apt term. I don't know of any downside to enacting this legislation. The idea of creating a false hope seems disingenuous to me. Terminal is terminal. So it seems to me like this is an easy call. And I'd point out as well that in the U.S. Constitution there is a guarantee to the right to the pursuit of happiness, not happiness itself, but the pursuit of happiness. And it seems to me that making potentially life-saving medications available would fall under that category. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Landfield. Next, we have Starley Coleman, who is connected, is the Vice President of Communications with the Goldwater Institute. Ms. Coleman, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman.
If you'll go ahead and proceed and state your affiliation as well.
Thank you. I'm Starley Coleman with the Goldwater Institute, and we are the organization that crafted the model right to try law upon which this bill is based. So you've already heard a lot of great reasons to support this bill, and I don't want to belabor the point. I just want to leave you with one additional anecdote that we think is really important for people in Alaska to understand. As part of our research, we have talked to doctors at major research facilities across the country about why they don't use the FDA's existing compassionate use process that Representative Grimm and Ms. Ivey explained to you earlier. And one of the best examples is from Dr. Rizelle Kurzrock. She used to run clinical trials for MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. And her trial center was the largest in the world, and she said that she was able to get maybe one person a year through the FDA expanded process. So my question is this. If only one person a year at the largest cancer trial center in the world can get access to a drug through the FDA's process, imagine what it's like for a person in Alaska who is seeing a community oncologist who's never run a clinical trial before, who doesn't know who to call at the FDA. The chances are not good that they are going to be helped through this program. The FDA program is really for patients who are being treated at major research hospitals where they do clinical trials all the time and they know who to call and how to navigate that system. It's not for regular people, but we know that Right to Try is already helping regular people. As you just heard from the previous testimony, and as I hope you do get to hear from Dr. Dalpasand, we know that it's working in Texas. We've also heard that patients in Oregon and Florida have been able to access new treatment options. These are real people with real families who need help. And one of the things that's also critical is that, you know, as we've worked across the country on this issue, as has been mentioned, it's actually been adopted in 34 states now. We just got confirmation today that it's been adopted in Kentucky. I've met hundreds of people.
Ms. Coleman, you're at about 2 minutes. If you could go ahead and conclude your remarks, that'd be great.
Sure, will do. You know, no one who is dying expects that an investigational treatment is going to cure them, but they want the right to try. They just want the choice to be able to take the same medication that is being used successfully in clinical trials, and we believe that we owe dying people and their families that opportunity. Thank you so much for your time today, and we hope we can count on your support.
Thank you very much. I would also note Linda Bruce with Legislative Legal is available on the phone if there are questions, and Janie Hovenen with the Division Director of the Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licenses here in the room. Looking at the list, we also have, that's all the people on the list for testifying. Is there anyone else in the room or online who would like to testify with regard to this bill? Hearing and seeing no one, I will close the public hearing. Are there any questions from the committee for the bill sponsor or any of the others that are available in the room? Representative Ledoux.
So I came in late. I apologize for that, but maybe you've already answered the question. How do you get a hold of these experimental drugs?
So for the record, Brooke Ivey, staff to Representative Grenn, through the chair, Representative Ledoux. Well, first of all, Representative Grenn had to run off to House Finance, so I do apologize. He had to step out. So at this time, the FDA has a compassionate use program that you can apply to for investigational drugs in conjunction with your doctor. You have to go through an application process. And after that point, once that's received, the FDA has up to 30 days to review your application. If a question comes up, that can reset that 30-day clock. And then after that point, if you do receive approval from the FDA, you and your doctor then have to seek out an external institutional review board, or IRB. The FDA does not find that for you. And so they have no requirements on when they have to get back to you by or approve your application. And so if they only meet every 6 months, you know, you would have to wait for them to review and approve your request. So that's the current process.
That's the current process.
Correct. And that would be the only way outside of a clinical trial you could access those investigational drugs.
So if that's the current process, then this bill, I mean, I see what it's doing with respect to not making your doctor subject to disciplinary action. But still, how are you supposed to get a hold of the drugs? Where are the drugs going to come from?
Certainly. So this would be, so to be eligible to work with your doctor, and then you would be also working with a drug manufacturer to access the drugs. So this would be a patient who has been diagnosed as terminally ill, has attempted to access a clinical trial, so they have already have an idea of the drug that they're hoping to, or the treatment they're trying. They've exhausted all other treatment options in conversation with their doctor. There's nothing on the shelves approved by the FDA that is working for or whatever terminal illness that they have. So they've gone through all these steps, and then rather than once either unable to access the clinical trial, they would then contact the drug manufacturer and see if they would consent to also providing that medication outside of the clinical trial, just as they might with the compassionate use program. So it's direct with you, your doctor, and the manufacturer, all of whom would have to consent to that relationship.
Good follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
Is this law or this type of legislation, is this been passed in other states? I'm just wondering how cooperative the drug companies are to dispensing the drugs under circumstances in which these types of laws have been enacted.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, this particular law, similar laws, right to try laws, have been passed, and now as of today in 34 states, and pending in 14 states, including Alaska. It's true that there is no forcible action you could take to require a drug manufacturer to provide access to the medication. One interesting element of this, though, is as of due to the new 21st Century Cures Act that passed at the federal level, there's a requirement that was included in that drug manufacturers now have to list on their websites and make it more accessible if they participate in the compassionate use program and who you would contact to access those medications. So it's becoming more accessible both for those who are seeking access to the compassionate use program and those who are seeking access outside of the compassionate use program.
And then one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Are any of these drugs available in other countries so that you could get them from other countries, even if they haven't been approved by our FDA?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's a very powerful question in my mind, because I think a lot of times when we talk about this legislation, we're thinking about experimental drugs we've never seen before, but some of the medications or treatments, going through the U.S. FDA approval process are actually, yes, currently in use. For example, in Europe, there's a lot of cancer treatments that have, say, been in use for 15 years successfully there, but they still have to go through our process, which on average, my understanding, could take anywhere from 10 to 15 years to be approved. So if they've passed phase one of the FDA approval process, per this legislation, you would be able to work with your doctor and the manufacturer to access those. So, yes.
So just one more.
One more follow-up. I would note, go ahead with the follow-up, but I'd note that Dr. Del Passon has now joined us on the phone, and he may actually have more knowledge about some of these things than.
Okay, well, I'll ask the question to whoever might be able to answer it. For drugs that are maybe available in other countries, but for some reason you're not able to obtain them from the manufacturer here, what would it take to import those drugs? I mean, I'm going to assume that this bill doesn't do it.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that is correct, and I'm honestly not sure that would be legal under federal law at this time. So, I mean, my understanding is the patient would have to travel to that country and utilize the drug in that geographical location.
Thank you.
So I did get a note that Dr. Ibrahim Delpassin has joined us. Dr. Delpassin, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you, sir.
And I had closed public testimony, but I'll be glad to hear your testimony now under invited testimony without reopening the public hearing. If you want to go ahead and start with your remarks, we try to limit the remarks to 2 minutes, but I suspect some members of the committee, after your remarks are concluded, may have some questions. And so if you'll stand by for questions, but go ahead and with your invited testimony.
Sure. Basically, I quickly introduce myself. I'm Ibrahim Delpassin. I'm a nuclear medicine physician and with a special interest in nuclear oncology. Basically, chairman, medical director of Excel Diagnostics and Nuclear Oncology Center.
If you could slow down just a little bit, I can see our recording secretary is... She's. I know the look when people are talking faster than she can type. If you'd slow down just a little bit.
Sure, because you gave me 2 minutes, so it's time to.
Well, I'll give you a little extra.
Yes, and I'm adjunct professor at the University of Texas Department of Radiation Oncology. I can comment that our situation. I mean, we have been using Right to Trila in the state of Texas in Houston in our practice. For patients to offer a special type of targeted radionuclide therapy for neuroendocrine cancers. These are kind of a rare cancers in terms of as compared to other common cancers such as prostate cancer or breast cancer or maybe colon cancer. But we have a special targeted therapy that was actually given to patients about more than 10 years ago in Europe. And our patients, they had to travel for getting this treatment, travel to Europe to get this treatment. So in 2007, I filed an investigation on new drug application with FDA to do this treatment in Houston, Texas, for our, for our population in U.S. And it took me about 2.5 years that it went through FDA. Finally, we got the approval to start this investigational trial. And it was mostly for purpose of giving, patients the access to this treatment. We did not, my institution was not owner of this drug, but I got permission from the owner of the drug to start this trial in U.S. because at that time they were not ready to start the trial. So we went through all the hoops, basically, and finally made it available to our patients. We did it under FDA sort of approval. In 2015, about 5 years later...
Can you slow down just a little bit again, because she's having a hard time following.
Sure. So, in 2015...
Pull back just a little bit from the phone you're talking on, because I think that's making it a little garbled as well.
Sure, I try to speak it slower, and also hopefully this phone will cooperate. Our IND was active in our center for treatment of these patients. We initially requested for 60 patients. Then obviously the drug still was not available. We increased that to 100 patients, and then 150 patients. In February of 2015, we were getting close to 150 patients. Enrollment, and then I send a letter to FDA requesting to do add another 100 patients to this number because the drug was not still commercially available. And FDA at that time said, no, we don't want to allow you to increase the number. And I asked them, has there been any complaint? Has there been anything that I don't know? I mean, as far as I know, our patients, they have had good responses. The drug has a very good safety profile. There are lots of peer-reviewed medical publications on this drug, both from our center as well as European centers. And they said, no, because we think it's going to affect on the commercialization of the drug, this is why you have to stop. And I mentioned to them that at this time, the investigational trial that is for approval of this drug has already completed enrollment. Actually, our center was one of the main contributors to that clinical trial. So there is no way that our continuation of treating these patients will affect on the commercialization of the drug.
Okay. Let me do this. If you could give some brief concluding remarks, I think that we have a few questions from the committee, and if you could conclude, and then we'll let those. But you can answer those questions.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
If you want to go ahead and conclude, and I think there are a couple of questions from the committee, but if you could go ahead and conclude, we've been going on for, even with some of the delays, about 4 minutes, so you've had plenty of time.
To continue our treatment while FDA essentially had stopped us to provide this treatment to the patient. So in this way, actually, this is one of the scenarios that right to trial can help to the patients to receive their treatment while FDA is reviewing all the data to approve the drug and later on becomes commercialized. So this is a time, there is a gap in here that definitely patients will benefit from this law if it is available to them to get their medications.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? I see on my list before, Representative Fansford, do you have questions for Dr. Del Pazin?
I don't think that any would pertain to him. I think all of mine, I've multiple ones, but I think all of mine would be probably
okay.
Better addressed
I'll
by the
I'll
bill
keep
sponsor.
You on the list. So there, Representative Reinbold, you had raised your hand. Do you want to ask a question?
Not for him.
Okay. Representative Kopp, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Del Pazin, for testifying. You mentioned some remarks about FDA decisions affecting the commercialization of the drug, which caught my attention. In your professional experience, have you ever witnessed or observed FDA collusion with pharmaceutical companies in expediting or delaying approvals of investigational drugs through phases 1-3 of clinical trials that you felt were harmful to patient interest?
Well, the nature of overall process regulatory approval is that so far it has been is a kind of a lengthy process. I mean, and there are several reasons for that. Number one, some of these clinical trials, FDA requires certain, obviously, follow-up information, certain long-term effect on the patient, and especially if you're talking about, oncology and cancer, they want to make sure, number one, the drug is safe and also effective. So it takes time. It is part of the nature of these kind of a clinical trials. And also, because it takes time, there is lots of data to look at, and when the final package is submitted to FDA, it takes sometimes between 12 to 18 months until FDA actually is able to review the entire data and come back with the opinion whether they approve it or not approve it. So this is a period of time that we see the problem, and especially if the drug is already showing effectiveness, there are lots of publications, the community, oncologists or whoever physician group that they are, following this drug, they have already read about this drug, they have seen several publications, it becomes a common knowledge, and then patients, they come and ask for it, and physicians, they know that such a drug is available, but it's not, it's shown efficacy, but it's not commercially available, but at the same time, they have the knowledge that this drug can help their patients. So in this situation, we don't have anything to offer because the drug is not commercially available and it's not approved yet. Yet, as a physician, I know that this drug can help my patients. So this is how right to try law comes into play. In certain situations, and this law is not by any means cutting short, having a shortcut or cutting the corner for FDA or any kind of due diligence in terms of making sure the drug is safe and effective.
Okay, Dr. Pell, I think that's answered the question. Did you have any follow-up, Representative Kopp? And any other questions from the committee for Dr. Del Pazin? I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much, Doctor, for joining us. I know that Representative, you can stand the line and listen. I know Representative Fanser has a question for the bill sponsor. Representative Fanser.
Sure, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, a couple of questions and comments. First off, I want to thank you, Ms. Ivey, and thank Representative Gren for bringing this issue before us. I didn't see a copy of the PowerPoint in our packet. Would there be a way you could get us a copy of that? if possible.
For the record, Brooke Ivey, staff to Representative Grudd, and through the chair, Representative Fansler, yes, and I believe that might have been distributed electronically to members, but we felt it was a little redundant with the items in your packet, but we'll certainly get that to you.
Sounds great. Thank you. And a couple of things here. Is the bill passed exactly the same in every state? Is it a universal type of bill, this language? Is this what is being has been passed in the other 34 states?
Through the chair, Representative Fansler, no, it's not the same in every state. It is, I believe most of the other versions that I've read from other states includes the same criteria. You must be diagnosed as terminally ill. You must be unable to participate in a clinical trial, it has a similar informed consent requirements and have exhausted all FDA-approved options, but there are different elements to each different state's statutes they passed.
And follow-up through the chair. I did notice in here that there was a letter that was attached that recommended some amendments, multiple amendments, adding a new section, but also changing the definition of terminal illness. And just wanted your reaction to those recommendations. And please.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Fansler. Yes, Representative Gren did receive a letter from Premier Blue Cross Blue Shield suggesting some potential amendments to House Bill 43. So the first two that are listed it's clarifying language that a healthcare insurer or a patient's healthcare insurance plan is not required to cover the investigational drugs or the adverse effects as a result of an investigational drug. Now, that is not required in federal, the coverage is not required in federal or state statute at this time. So if it was the will of the committee, it could be included for clarification purposes, but at this point, it isn't something that we're trying to require in the bill, that coverage. Also, I'd note that part of the informed consent form, the written consent that is required in the bill, involves a conversation between a doctor and their patient regarding the lack of coverage for the investigational drug. That's sort of FDA guidance on those informed consent forms. The third element that they include in their recommendation has to do with what they may not deny coverage for. And so our reading of this indicates that it might add additional protections to the bill for the patient, in that a healthcare insurer may not deny coverage to a patient for pre-existing conditions, benefits that accrued before the day on which the patient was treated with the unapproved investigational drug, or palliative care for a patient previously treated who is no longer currently using the investigational drug. My understanding is that majority of this is already mandated in the Affordable Care Act. However, if it could be something that the committee could consider including if they wanted to look down the road to see there might be changes at the federal level. We spoke with legal services about this language, and didn't indicate that there were particular risks involved in including it. Finally, the definition of terminal illness is one. This definition that Premier has suggested would streamline it with Medicare's definition of terminal illness and limit it to those who may be considered terminally ill. They may die in the next 6 months. We felt that this was a little bit of a narrow definition, in that if you were diagnosed as terminally ill and you were given 7 months to live, you would not be eligible to participate in the right to try. And we don't see these stringent sort of this level of narrow definition even through the compassionate use program, so we wouldn't necessarily support that amendment.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fansler.
Thank you, through the chair, Ms. Ivey. Thank you for the map. I mean, it shows to me that there's almost universal acceptance of this program, seeing 34 now states that are green, and you know, 14 others where it's working its way through the legislature in some way. But I notice in one case, it looks like we have Hawaii, if my recognition of geography is correct, that for some that for some reason vetoed this. And do you have any information as to why, if every other state has felt this is a good idea?
Sure. Representative Fansler, through the chair. So previously, the governor of California, Governor Brown, had vetoed when they the House and Senate passed the right to try law in California, and then later they brought that legislation forth again, and he changed his mind based on the success stories that he's seen. For example, Dr. Delpison in Texas and the patients that he's been able to treat, which I know is a little hard to hear over the phone, but that's actually quite a powerful story. But as far as Hawaii goes, Governor Ige, in his veto statement, basically listed four reasons. The first was that the compassionate use program already exists and already provides access. The second was that this could interfere with the overall FDA system, which may have unintended consequences of delaying development of potentially life-saving drugs, which, you know, I think the bill sponsors would argue that given that this doesn't damage clinical trials and that patients must have already tried to apply for a clinical trial and been denied, that this actually doesn't impact that phase 1-3 clinical trial process. Number three, he felt it violated the Supremacy Clause, which, you know, and then number four, he just was unclear as to what the actual benefits to the patient would be. So that was my understanding of his position on that.
Okay. Thank you. And one final follow-up, if I may.
Representative Fan.
You spoke to the powerfulness of Dr. Delpison's testimony. Could he perhaps submit written testimony for us or something along those lines? Or maybe it's in here and I missed it.
Representative Fansler, through the chair, yes, of course. I was actually already going to follow up with him on that because it would be great for you to be able to read his position.
All right,
on how that's been successful.
Thank you. Representative Reinbold, you're next on my list.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you. This was actually it's more of a very brief question, but then more of a comment. So you need to tell me if this is the appropriate time.
Let's just get with questions for the bill sponsor. We're not going to pass the bill out today. We have, I think, three more things on the agenda today. But you can certainly ask your question, and if a brief comment is fine too.
Okay. Okay. So basically, what my question was is this bill is definitely just limited. It's not encompassing any other type of health care. It's strictly just the right to try in pharmaceuticals. Is that correct?
Representative Reinbold, through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay, so I guess I'll make a quick comment. Basically, this is just something that's really important to me. We all talk about whether we're lawyers or cops or firemen or things like that in our past. It often comes up in our daily discussions. I was in pharmaceutical sales for almost 10 years in Alaska. So this is a big deal to me to have this bill. And I'll be honest, I was quite skeptical at first, you know, when this came, and I had to send it to a lot of advisors. But just to answer Representative Ledoux's question, for my company that I worked for, it took about 17 years to get from the very, very beginning inception to the actual final approval of that product. It was a very, very long process. And they are international companies, and so, as you know, that a lot of these drugs can be obtained overseas, and with the right appropriations, they can be brought in for trials in the United States. So that's just a follow-up in regards to her but anything from antibiotics to GCOI reductase and the statins and all those kind of drugs. I even sold monoclonal antibodies in the state, so it was a long, long process that I dealt with pharmaceuticals. And going to indulge just for a second, I was actually the first woman and the first district business manager in the state of Alaska for a big pharmaceutical company, and that was a huge deal in Alaska. And I got the privilege of working with PharmDs, pharmaceutical doctors of pharmacy, and so we actually got to place grants We actually got to get people on clinical trials in Alaska. And we had to compete with California. We had to compete with all these big states. So getting people in Alaska on clinical trials is so much of a bigger deal than what you would think it would be because of the competition that we have with other states. It's easier just to get a whole bunch of patients in a very concentrated effort. So I'm really thankful that this bill actually got brought up in Alaska. And with caution, I'm going to be encouraging still continuing to vet it, but with caution. But I do think the comment that in regards to giving false hope is a very valid question, because I just had a girlfriend that got on a trial, a clinical trial down in California, and she was given a lot of great hope that this was going to be the very successful thing for her, and it ended up dashing her hopes, and she didn't get any type of resolve at all. So I just think that people need to not think this is sliced bread, that this is a risk benefit analysis, but I do think it's a good opportunity that Alaska has the opportunity to participate.
Thank you, Representative Randall. Any other questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Eastman? And I will not, my hope is to bring this back on Monday, but go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So a question for the bill sponsor. Now, with the success of the legislation in more than 30 different states, and now with states beginning to try and expand the program to the chronically ill, what is the bill sponsor's perspective on an amendment that might expand it to chronically ill based on that success?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, yes, it's my understanding that in Texas, due to their success with the right to try law, I believe that's the one state looking at potentially expanding the definition of terminal illness to reach beyond, and I believe debilitating diseases might be what they're looking at. I did reach out to the Goldwater Institute as the drafters of the model legislation on that concept and if they're involved in that with Texas. At this time, they do have concerns that they'd like to see this initial narrow definition, because it is kind of a new process that they look at vetting that as it goes through the different states, trying that out before looking to expand. Additionally, there could be a potential court challenge right now with the narrow definition of terminal illness, because we're really targeting, I guess, as the bill sponsor, we're really trying to target an existing access through compassionate use, but trying to streamline that timing. Expanding the definition could potentially get into questions as to if we're taking on the FDA at a larger scope in terms of their process and how far you might expand that definition. So that's really a policy call, but at this time, the sponsor plans to would prefer to stay with the more narrow definition of terminal illness.
Follow-up,
Representative Eastman.
Also through the chair, and I know there are several parallels with this bill and a separate bill currently making its way through the legislature dealing with assisted suicide. I'm wondering, since they are so similar, what is the sponsor's thought to putting language into the bill that would make it clear that that's definitely not the direction of this bill?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, it's the bill sponsor's position that these bills are very different, as the intent is completely different. The right to die, I think, is what you're referring to, versus right to try. However, we would be open to discussion on just adding language that doesn't to clarify that.
Okay, thank
certainly.
You.
Representative Ledoux.
Is there any organized opposition to this bill? Or has there been organized opposition to similar bills in other states?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, not to my knowledge in Alaska. I think some of the main points of opposition have been, nationally speaking, have been concern over creating false hope, which, in response to that, some have said it's better to have some hope than no hope at all. But I will tell you that at the state level, the state medical board has written a letter of support, as has the Commission on Aging, has written a letter of support, which are included in your packets. In terms of the national scope, I might have to defer to Starley Coleman with the Goldwater Institute, if you are interested in hearing from her on that.
Thank you. And one further question?
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
So I see somewhere in this paperwork that I have, it looks like Aetna, or maybe it's Primera, one of the insurance companies, has written asking for an amendment, and I'm wondering what the sponsor's view of that amendment is.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I think that letter from Premier Representative Fansler did ask about previously. Is that the one we're referring to? Yeah.
The March 7th one.
Correct. So just real briefly, the first two suggested changes the sponsor feels may be a little redundant or unnecessary, as they're not currently requiring insurers to cover investigational drugs under federal or state statute. The third, we could add additional protections if it was desire of the committee. But again, some of these are mandated by the Affordable Care Act already. Finally, in terms of narrowing the scope of the definition of terminal illness, at this time we do not support that.
Thank you.
That narrow version.
Any other questions for the bill sponsor? I don't see any questions. I would note my plan is to bring this bill back on Monday and hopefully pass it in a committee at that time, but we will hold House Bill 43 at this time for further review. If anyone is considering an amendment to House Bill 43, please let my office know of that your interest in doing so and submit any amendments to House Bill 43 by 5 p.m. on Friday. So we will hold House Bill 43. Next is House Bill 108, which is our second order of business today, fiduciary access to digital assets. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. As I am the sponsor of the bill, I'm going to pass the gavel to my vice chair, Representative Fansler, for the duration of our hearing on House Bill 108.
Thank you, Representative Clayman. Once again, our second order of business is House Bill 108. Last week, we adopted version U as our working document. We heard public testimony and we held the bill for further review. Committee members did not submit any amendments for House Bill 108, so that brings the bill back before the committee. Is there any further discussion regarding House Bill 108?
Question.
Sure. Representative Kopp.
Yes. Just a question to the bill sponsor. Representative Clayman, has there been any organized opposition to this that you've encountered?
Not that I've been aware of. Actually, probably the better person to ask that would be Deborah Baer, who's here and with the representative on the Uniform Laws Commission, and I think she's probably better prepared to answer that. Whether there's been opposition on a national level or within any particular states that have heard this bill.
For the record, my name is Deborah Baer, and I'm an Alaska Uniform Law Commission member. And Alaska has been a member since 1914 with this, and this is legislation that's passed already in 24 states and is pending in another 18, two, and of those 18, two are on the governor's desk. The legislation you have before you, there's been no organized opposition to it. On Google, Facebook, industry has supported it. Senior groups, ARP in Alaska has supported it, and a major trust company in Alaska has supported it. I'm not aware of anyone raising any objections to it, serious objections.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions for either the bill sponsor or Ms. Baer? All right. Seeing none, I will now ask for final comments from members. Seeing no comments, may I have a motion?
Vice Chair, Coom Chair, I move version 30-LS0210/U of committee substitute for House Bill 108 with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, we will move House Bill 108 version U from this committee, and I will hand back the gavel to the chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Fansler. Our third order of business today is House Bill 42, Forfeiture and Seizure Procedure and Limits, which is sponsored by Representative Wilson, and I see that a representative from her staff is here. This is the fifth hearing of this bill. Last meeting, we took up amendments. Amendments 1, 2, and 3 were adopted. Amendment 4 failed, and Amendments 5, 6, and 7 were withdrawn. Since the last meeting, I worked with committee members in the Department of Law, as well as the bill sponsor, to redraft Amendment number 4, which now is before you on your desk as Amendment number 8. Hard copies of the amendment were dropped by committee members' offices last night. I have a motion to bring Amendment 8 before the committee.
I move Amendment number 8.
Is there any objection to Amendment number 8? Hearing and seeing no objections, then we have adopted Amendment number 8. And that's adopted. That brings back before us House Bill 42. Any further discussion about House Bill 42 as amended from members of the committee? Representative Eastman, I thought we were almost going to be silent.
I hate to disappoint, Mr. Chairman.
No disappointment.
With all the changes to this bill, my thought is that we're not accomplishing everything that I think the original bill set out to. However, I am hopeful that with passage of this bill, we can take a small step closer to where we want to be. Thank you.
Any other comments as to the bill as amended?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kopp.
I appreciate the efforts of law and Representative Wilson and members of this whole committee. I felt like it was a team effort getting it to move forward. It may not have accomplished everything that was intended, but not everything that was intended was beneficial overall to good public policy. But certainly the bill sponsor's intent, which was to make sure there's due process any time there's a seizure of property and forfeiture, I think we've taken great strides in that direction and look forward to seeing it pass.
Any other discussion or comments from members of the committee? I don't hear and see anything. May I have a motion?
Get my script away.
Got to catch up on the script.
I do. We're moving too fast. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move version 30-LS0193/U of committee substitute for House Bill 42 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Hearing and seeing no objection, House Bill 42 moves from committee, and as usual, please sign the paperwork as it works its way through. Our final order of business today is House Bill 123, Disclosure of Healthcare Costs, sponsored by Representative Sponholz. This is the third hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. At this time, I would like to move on to amendments. Hard copies of amendments were dropped by committee members' offices last night and sent out by email as well. As a reminder for members, the maker of the amendment will make a motion. If no one objects, the amendment passes. And, of course, if there is an objection, the member can and will speak to the amendment. Then if the objection is maintained, the amendment will be put to a vote. And we have, I believe, four amendments. May I have a motion for the first amendment?
Mr. Chair, as the maker of the first amendment, can I pass or roll to the bottom? And the reason is I have some fresh data from NCCI that I'd at least like to circulate among committee members as well as the bill sponsor.
I'm more than happy to move amendment number one to the bottom of the stack. I have a motion as to amendment number two. Representative Reinbold.
Just move amendment number two.
Object.
Representative Reinbold, if you can explain amendment number two.
When I initially talked to the bill sponsor, I had mentioned this in her office. This basically just removes the federal exemptions. They're the public, so that if we do use, and in her office, she didn't say she had that opposition to this. So this basically just keeps everybody on the same, page.
And actually, I'm We do. Why don't we take a brief at ease? Because a few minutes ago, the bill sponsor was in the front row and listening carefully to the other bills. So let's take a brief at ease so we can get the bill sponsor back, because you raised a good question. We would like to know her position on that. So we'll take a brief at ease. The bill sponsor's representative is here. We have before us amendment number 2, and I think the initial question that Representative Reinbold had is whether the bill sponsor is here as well. Representative Sponholz has also joined us. I think the first question for Representative Reinbold was whether the bill sponsor supports or does not support amendment number 2.
Do you want me to review it with you?
No, I have it. I just want to make sure that I have my notes in front of me. I'll be able to speak more articulately if I have my notes.
Give her a moment. Identify yourself for the record.
Representative Ivy Sponholz, District 16 in East Anchorage, and we are talking about amendment number
2.
I-3,
that's
correct.
Make
sure I'm in the correct order since I've just walked into the room. Unfortunately, I can't support this particular amendment. It's in conflict with the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, which is Article 6 of the Constitution, and there is not actually a bright line separating government institutions from private institutions in this bill. Instead, what it is, it's separating out the only separation that's clearly not included are federally funded organizations, which is my understanding the Supremacy Clause does not allow us to do, and would put us in the position of having to defend costly lawsuits, which I don't think is in the best interest of our state in this particular tight fiscal time.
So Representative Reinbold, I'll now give you a chance to explain amendment number 2, and then we'll get to questions.
In all fairness, I did talk to her in her office, and my impression of what you said is you didn't have any strong feelings one way or another, and I don't know if you've come to new conclusions since then, but my personal opinion in regards to this is federal dollars are private tax dollars, okay? They come out of our pockets, you know, or our businesses. So those are private sector dollars going to fund public facilities. All this amendment does is it eliminates exemptions for public facilities that are funded by private dollars. So now this seems to be an oxymoron to me, where we're asking our private sector people to publish publicly their fees, but the public sector, who takes from the private sector to fund their facilities, now get exemptions, and it just seems to be outlandish now in my mind. And also state facilities. Also, you know, and federal, sometimes there's matches, like Medicaid dollars and things go to them. So it's also the people's resources, the people's money that are going to these. And I think that it's only fair that we have the public facilities on the same playing field as the private sector at minimum, if not more. Maybe the public people should be posting and maybe not the private sector people should be posting. So,
thank you. Next, I have Representative Ledoux.
So I follow what you're saying when it comes to about the federal supremacy clause. Mm-hmm. When it comes to page 3, not line 18, mm-hmm. inserting federal. But I don't necessarily follow it when it comes to page 3, lines 24 and 25. For example, the Alaska Pioneers Home, mm-hmm. an assisted living facility, a nursing facility licensed by the department to provide long-term care, and I'm not sure about D, the tribal health organization. But I mean, why wouldn't a nursing facility licensed by the department to provide long-term care, how would that be a federal thing?
And that is not. Just to clarify, the second section, and what I was speaking to was the first section that inserts federal into it. The second section, which would delete out the Pioneer Homes, Veterans Homes, Assisted Living Homes, and Nursing Facilities in particular, we chose not to include those in the bill because actually everybody who attends every one of those facilities already knows going into it exactly what that's going to cost. Nobody goes into a long-term care facility or the Pioneers Home without knowing exactly what it costs every day. And so having it posted on the wall is sort of just it's not additional information, was my sense in that particular case. You don't walk up or, you know, walk up and say, hey, I think I'd like to go to the Pioneer Home today and move in. You know, when you're planning on going to the Pioneer Home, you talk to the Pioneer Home about what they charge, about how much any insurance you might have is going to cover, how much you're going to have to pay out of pocket. That's all very, very clear because it's a very specific and planned. It's a very distinct kind of service. In the case of the tribal health organizations and E, which includes a hospital operated by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the United States Department of Defense, it was our understanding that because the tribal health organizations were largely federally funded, we've received verbal feedback that there would probably be a lawsuit that would come if this that was included, because they view themselves as being a part of a federal entity. So if this committee wants to take that on, that's a separate issue. I chose not to because my primary focus was on making sure that the individual marketplace, which is the place where most of us are getting our health care at private health care settings, is the place where I think we have the most opportunity to make a big difference.
Just follow up?
Representative Ledoux.
So how about a nursing facility licensed by the department to provide long-term care? I mean, my understanding with respect to some of these facilities is that maybe there's basic stuff that is provided. In other words, you're like living there. Mm-hmm. But there's other stuff that's provided upon request or necessity. But, I mean, I'm thinking more in terms of my folks down in California. And I remember my father broke his hip. Mm-hmm. And so he had to go for a while into a long-term care facility. And they billed him for specific services there. It wasn't just that, you know, he had to pay X amount of dollars in order to enter the place. So, but I don't know how they're run here. And maybe you do.
My understanding is that they tend to be you pay a fee for the level of care that you receive, and that the pricing tends to, and there may still be some individual distinctions, but the pricing tends to be based on the level of care that you need. So if you need, a fully assisted living, facility where you've got a skilled nurse on hand all of the time and you have, oxygen and a series of things, that's one level of care. If you need a lower level of care with more independence, but you need access to, supportive transitions in and out of your bed, that's a different level of care, and that there's different pricing for those different levels of care. But that generally speaking, you know what you're getting into, and your bill doesn't change very dramatically from one month to another based on those differences, unless you have a major medical event, in which case there would clearly be a distinction because you would need to bring in additional supports.
Thank you.
I would just say that that's a very different kind of care than the kinds of sort of more routine and or elective care that we're talking about when we're talking about going to our traditional healthcare provider. And it was our intent to focus in on that routine and elective care that I think makes up the bulk of the particular kind of marketplace. I think we can influence this way. You need long-term care, whether you need it. If you need it, you need it, right? You do some shopping around, probably, but if you need it, you need it.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you. I guess question to the bill sponsor also with respect to amendment number two. So dealing with the first part of the amendment, talking about inserting federal, thinking through your answer, so any person who's eligible for health care under the Indian Health Service or is a provider under that program, that is all a federal program with federal money, and it's really not competing in the marketplace with respect to price transparency as far as my understanding.
My understanding as well, okay. Representative Kopp.
Okay, thank you. And also, with respect to federal, how could this impact military hospitals? So we have a big one on J-Bear. Mm-hmm. And I'm really not familiar with how TriStar works right now. It's changed a lot, but I think that I don't know if, again, the intent being marketplace transparency mm-hmm. is aligned with having a military hospital have a price disclosure.
Right. So, Representative Kopp, through the chair, I think we're talking about two distinct elements when we're talking about this one specific population mm-hmm. that's served through TRICARE and through the Veterans Affairs or the DOD-delivered health care services. In the case of the federal facilities, which are operated on bases or just outside of the military bases, in the case of the Department of Veterans Affairs, those are excluded on page 4 under line E, bullet E. A hospital operated by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and or United States Department of Defense or any other federally operated hospital or institution, that's the second, that's the place where that or one of the places where that federal omission is included, and we treated those as separate because those are federal institutions. But if you are a veteran with TRICARE and you have received some sort of approval, and I understand now that they do have more flexibility, veterans do, to receive care outside of the military system, and you're going to a private provider in the marketplace, which you can do, I believe that you should be able to see that information. And you can use TRICARE within the private market within some restrictions, and I don't know all the details of that. I'm not an expert in TRICARE. I just happen to know that you can use it outside of military installations.
One follow-up, Mr.
Representative Kopp.
So with respect to lines 4 and 5 of Representative Reinbold's amendment number 2, if we just deleted D and E, the Alaska Tribal Health Organizations and the hospitals operated by DOD and Veterans Affairs, would there be any problem with leaving the three places that the Pioneers Home, Veterans Home, Assisted Living Homes, and Nursing Facilities?
So the way the bill is written is actually the inverse, because the way it's written as a healthcare facility does not include.
I'm sorry. I said that backwards.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So yeah. you're suggesting that we would continue to exclude D, which is tribal facilities, mm-hmm. And E, which is DOD and DVA facilities. Would that be amenable? Am I amenable to that in particular? Is that the question?
Mm-hmm.
I don't object to it. I'm not necessarily sure that it's the same thing. When you go to an assisted living home, I don't believe anybody goes to an assisted living home without getting a price and knowing exactly how much it's going to cost and how you're going to be charged and what for and how you're going to pay for it. So I think the need for transparency isn't the same. I wouldn't necessarily object to that. I don't see that the need is at that same level. It's a very different thing when you walk into an emergency room and you're considering getting an MRI, or when you're going to your local doctor and you're considering whether or not you get additional blood work, than it is when you go to the Pioneer Home or an assisted living home, where I believe, as I've already testified, that nobody goes into those facilities without already having looked at that. That said, I don't necessarily object to it. I just don't see what's really served by having them included.
I'll just note in that respect, just to kind of add my own experience dealing with my parents, which was in Texas, when we were trying to decide what community to put them in assisted living, and my brother and sister and I were all very involved, I can tell you that we talked of somewhere between 4 and 6 different assisted living centers, and we knew exactly the price for every single one of them. There was nothing ambiguous about what price. I mean, price transparency was not the issue. We knew the price, and then we made a decision based on knowing the price. And not only that, but I can tell you, as the guy that was writing the checks, that it was pretty much exactly what they predicted it would be. There wasn't anything missing in terms of the discussion. I think at one point my mother went to the emergency room, and that. Then we went into another world. but that's not, that wasn't the assisted living center. I apologize for that taking in place, but Representative Eastman, you're next in the queue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A number of different issues have been raised. I'll try and take them one at a time. So first, on the topic of federal jurisdiction, I think it, you know, it certainly makes perfect sense for the National, you know, Veterans Affairs Department to be able to determine what goes on in its facilities and to keep those standards consistent state to state. Certainly they're in all 50 states, and I'm glad they're in our state. If each state were to, you know, rewrite its own rules for how the VA operated in their particular state, that would get very confusing very quickly. And you may have the VA unable to provide the same level of service in particular states if there's new and onerous requirements that are being, you know, imposed. And that's just if the state could impose them. Obviously, it's, I think you would find that it would not be possible for us to regulate traffic signals on military bases and those types of things, because it is, it's a federally run facility, and I think you run into that same type of issue if we were requiring by law the federal folks to do something, even if it was a good something. Now, that said, that's a very different argument from, you know, the federal medical facilities don't compete with the private sector or compete in the market, because they absolutely do in this state in any number of situations compete. And I'll tell you one, you know, notable example is the Alaska Native Medical Center. ANMC certainly does provide treatment for those who are federally eligible beneficiaries, but they are not the only folks being served, and I can tell you that because there have been any number of times when we have, you know, put somebody in an ambulance and taken them to ANMC because ANMC had the facilities and they had the trauma support and the staff, and they are the only hospital in Anchorage that has the ability to serve, you know, multiple trauma cases simultaneously, and we've had bad car accidents where, you know, that's been the case. We've needed to go there. And they're very welcoming in any number of cases, being able to use their vacant beds and so forth and compete with other aspects of the private sector. So I don't think it's so much that there's no competition there. It's, you know, if we were to make a request of those in the federal side, it would simply be a request. And I think we should realize that those who are competing with the private sector, you know, may hearken to that request and they say, well, you know what, it makes sense to post prices and those types of things because they're competing and they want business and that side of things. So if it were a request of our federal partners, I think that there's probably good reason for that. A demand's probably more than we can accomplish as the legislature. On the topic of the Pioneers Home and Alaska Veterans Home assisted living homes, I'll say to that point, you know, we've also in the medical world done any number of services and visits to some of those facilities, you know, EMTs and firefighters, and you bet they all, I would look at it much the same as I would, you know, sending a child to a boarding school. Yeah, you have a price for admission, but at that school, you might have any number of different tuition requirements and costs and privatization or personalizing of services. Once you are at a facility, you're, you know, not locked into getting exactly the same types of procedures and services that, you know, every other resident of that school or of that, you know, senior center, assisted living home is receiving. Now, there may, and there are, in fact, you know, some organizations that do, you know, kind of give you the whole Cadillac plan, and you don't have to necessarily spend anything more than that because you're already, you know, paying for all the services up front. But I don't think that's a requirement that those types of facilities operate in that manner. something that's concerning that I'm hearing is kind of the idea that we need transparency for all of the various facilities covered in this bill because it doesn't currently exist. But if there's, you know, somewhere where it's already working well, i.e. a senior center or something like that, then we don't need to require the transparency because they're already doing it. That may be well and good, but I would hope for consistency and equity in applying these requirements to everyone here in Alaska. I think it would be very odd if, you know, you walk into one type of facility and you see your prices on the wall and you get accustomed to that, and then you walk next door or across the street and you go to, you know, a state-run facility and you ask where the prices are, and they say, well, you know, we just don't feel like doing that. Well, regardless of how people feel like doing it or not, I think if we're going to make that requirement should be made for everyone. And everyone can, we can develop that culture of price transparency, and that can exist regardless of the type of facility that you happen to be going to. So with the previous comment about, you know, not telling our federal partners, you know, what they can be doing in federal property, I think other aspects of the amendment do make sense. And if we don't have federal inserted at line 18, then there's really no reason to have any of the federal references in DRE anyways. So I kind of like what Representative Kopp's talking about, distinguishing between A, B, and C on the one hand and D and E on the other hand. And if you don't have federal to begin with, then you've already precluded them from the definition of a healthcare facility, so there's no reason to list them, you know, specifically under things that don't qualify as being under the definition of healthcare facility.
Representative Reingold, I'll wait to see if anybody else to give you the last word on your amendment. Representative Fanzler has amendment number 2. And Representative Reingold, I'm reserving you the right for wrap up on amendment 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair, I guess I just see a difference between A, B, and C, and kind of what this bill is attempting to provide. I think that I can't walk in to an assisted living facility and say, "Hey, can you mend my broken arm?" or something like that. That's something that I have to be living there to get that kind of assistance. So I do think that in those situations, what we're trying to do is very much encourage this transparency, so that, you know, if there's an elective surgery or something like that, I know what's gonna, you know, I know where I want to go, based on that. If I have, you know, maybe I need a scope on my knee or something like that, I can look at that, but I can't necessarily go into the Pioneer's home and they're not going to scope my knee. They're not going to do that kind of elective thing. As for D and E, I do see, you know, their complete difference, obviously, with the supremacy clause, and also I think perhaps when we are requiring the facilities we can require to do this, if the federal facilities suddenly are no longer taking in the patients they once did because they don't have that transparency, chances are that the free market will pull them into the transparency on its own. So, thank you.
I don't see any other comments. Representative Reingold, in wrap-up and amendment number 2.
I'm not sure if it's quite wrap-up yet because I was responding to Representative Kopp from probably 10 minutes ago.
You can respond, but also make your wrap-up.
Okay, so basically I was just going to say I'm certainly open to a friendly amendment if you so choose. I'm not sure if today is, you know, if we're not moving this out, but I certainly am open to talking. I would also work with the sponsor, of course. But I guess I have been looking at both the supremacy clause here, which thank you guys for helping me with this itty-bitty writing between the last Constitution and the federal Constitution. But I see this, I would like a Department of Law to weigh in on this. I don't think the Supremacy Clause has anything to do with this. I think it's an overuse of that clause. However, I would go to Amendment 9, and it said that the enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed or deny or disparage others retained by the people. And the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited in the states are reserved for the states respectively or to the people. So I guess my question to the sponsor of the bill, is it your intention that the private sector, have to publicly post their CPT codes and their fees, however the public sector, using private sector dollars, does not have to do this?
I would just clarify that on page 3, line 18, it says healthcare facility means private, municipal, or state hospital, psychiatric hospital, independent diagnostic. There's a whole long list, several of which include public entities. So as I've said several times, the distinction is not between public and private institutions. The only ones that are carved out that specifically because of the Supremacy Clause are federal in nature. That was the only distinction.
Could we have Mr. Chairman? Can we have Department of Law please weigh in on this Supremacy Clause, because I think it's a misuse of the Supremacy Clause?
Representative Ludu's raising her hand.
I just wanted to say that, Wong, I don't pretend to be an expert in the Supremacy Clause. There's actually a long line of legal opinions which say that the state can't basically make the federal government do things. We, for example, the state can't tax the federal government. So while the states don't always have to adhere to what the federal government tells them to do, we can't make the federal government do things.
And
that's sort of a long line of judicial precedents.
So Representative Reinbold, let me just make a couple of comments. I agree completely with what Representative Ledoux has indicated about the Supremacy Clause. And it is my intention to move this bill out of committee today and not to hold it any further. I think the question of the Supremacy Clause came up at the last meeting on this bill, and that issue is not a new discussion today. And I think that's a good question for you to have followed up with either Department of Law or alleged legal before we got here today. I indicated at the last hearing my intention to move the bill, so I don't think there's any reason to call alleged legal on the Supremacy Clause issue, because I think it really, the courts have consistently ruled again and again and again, exactly as Representative Ledoux described. So I'm not going to call alleged legal. And I'll give you a minute to make final comments on Amendment Number 2, and then we'll take a vote on Amendment Number 2, because I think you want to move forward, and I'm clear from Representative Cantor's comments that he will maintain his objection.
Well, I find this amazing. Okay. This has never happened before, to not get Department of Law, not to get Ledge Legal, to hurry, rush, because I was on the, sitting, listening to the committee till 3:15, the bill, we first heard it on Friday, and I think we went till 3:30 in regards to the bill. So I just think it's very, very important for either Ledge Legal or the Department of Law to weigh in regards to the Supremacy Clause, because I absolutely believe this is a misuse of that Supremacy Clause. And I think that, we need to be discussing the Ninth Amendment and the Tenth Amendment as well in regards to this. And I'm a huge Federalist, and I do believe that the rights that are not absolutely specifically, and I see nothing in the Constitution that says that they can't, post, or they shouldn't be transparent with public dollars. It just seems to me outlandish to be using that Supremacy Clause in this case. But neither here nor there. I just think that if we're going to do this, we need to have it on a fair playing field, and that if we're asking the private sector to do something that may violate antitrust laws, that may be controversial, that may pin the patient against the provider, if we're going to be doing something like this, I think that we need to all be on the same playing field, and that all public facilities should be held to the same standard.
Okay, thank you very much. The clerk could call the roll for a vote on Amendment Number 2.
Yes. Representative Fansler?
No.
Nay.
Representative Eastman?
Yay.
Yay. Representative Reinbold?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Kopp?
No.
Nay. Representative Christ-Tompkins?
No.
Nay. Representative Ledoux?
No.
Nay. Chair Klayman?
No.
Nay. That's 5-2.
2-5.
Oh, excuse me. 2-5.
Thank you. Representative Reinbold, could I have a motion with respect to amendment number 3?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 3.
Object.
And Representative Reinbold, if you could explain the intent of amendment number 3. And I'd also note, just in the interest of time, I'm going to ask that members keep our comments to 3 minutes each. Go ahead, Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This just was a request from a constituent, and they just want to make sure that other Medicare and Medicaid and the prices basically that are paid by the insurance companies are posted as well.
Representative Sponholz, any comments with respect to amendment number 3?
I appreciate the intent of trying to expand transparency. Unfortunately, in looking at amendment, I can't support it at this time. When I'm looking at lines 15 and 16, it asks for the total cost to the insurer for each of those health care services during that period. I'm not exactly sure what that means. There is a variety of definitions of health care costs that are out there. Are they talking about, you know, is the amendment referencing, you know, the total amount that they've paid out, in which case that's getting to a totally different issue than my bill is. My bill is about informing consumer price transparency. If we're looking at, you know, we spent, you know, this insurer spent $10 million on, you know, X number of services, that's sort of a different thing. It could also mean, you know, what are they paying to different providers, and that would vary depending on whether or not that provider was within their preferred provider network or was there out of, you know, provider network. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out the best way to have, you know, a clean, clear bill that was understandable by the end user, and I think that this muddies the water, unfortunately, a little bit. It's not very clear to me what this means.
Do I get the opportunity to explain?
Well, actually, Representative Ledoux is next in the queue.
Actually, and I was just going to ask the maker of the amendment to explain, because I'm reading this and I'm not quite sure what it's getting at, and I'm not sure whether this is so that the doctors can see what the insurance companies are going to pay or whether the consumer is going to see that. I'm just confused about it.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. So basically, as we all know, that there's fees that are going to be possibly posted when you walk in, and they're going to be the rack rate fees, is my understanding. So the physician that I've been speaking with, they actually provided me a list. And for example, a CPT code, like you guys want the top 25 CPT codes, that's the procedure codes. Mm-hmm. I was in healthcare for many years, and so basically what's going to show, and so it's going to look really, really expensive, you know, when you just pop up and look at CPT code 97164. So the current fee, the rack rate, would be $142. However, then changes happen. And let's say it's an employment injury. So the amount that they get reimbursed for that $142 is only $93. Well, then if you go for a private sector, like a usual and customary price there, that's a $79 reimbursement. However, federal workers in UAA with Blue Cross Blue Shield pays $142 for that reimbursement. Then Medicare only pays $54. It's basically complete transparency, so you actually see what the major providers are actually paying. So, you know, the patients freak out and say, oh, she's going to charge me $200. Well, really, the reimbursement rate is only a fraction of that. And it gets much more complicated. When I was in the business office, managing a business office down in Texas, we actually had managed care, and we were only allowed to charge like $400, even though the fee, the rack rate fee, might have been $10,000. We were only we had negotiated a very low price, and I guess that's what we're getting at with this amendment is the reimbursable price that the insurance pay is also transparent as well.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? I don't hear and seeing any. Representative Ledoux.
You know, I'm sympathetic to what this amendment is trying to do. But it becomes so much more complicated in that way. So, just like we were talking about a previous bill, that things around here are sometimes done through baby steps. I'm not going to support this amendment, not because I don't think that it ultimately might be a good idea. I just think that in the context of this bill right now, it's not going to work.
And any other comments? I'll make a couple of comments before your wind-up, Representative. Representative Eastman, go ahead.
Just a question for the amendment sponsor real quick. I noticed on page 2, line 3, looks like the fine is...
The bill or the amendment?
The amendment. That the fine seems to have tripled, and I was wondering why it went from $50 a day to $150 a day.
A good question for the writer of that was nothing that I asked her to do. So I think we need Glover on the line.
Mr. Chair.
No, Andrew.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Spondowitz.
Thank you. I will also point out that that the amendment as it's written does not do what I believe the amendment writer had intended. If the intention was to get more price transparency up in the doctor's office so that a consumer could see what the insurer would charge for the service, that is not accomplished by the way that this bill, this amendment is drafted. This amendment actually requires the healthcare insurer to list this information, and so you would have to go to your doctor's office and see what they listed on the wall, and rather than, as the disclosure statement will allow, go to your doctor's office and say, okay, I've got, you know, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, whatever plan, what will I pay really? You would go to your insurer's website and then see what the insurer says they would pay. And essentially, actually, is the a source at the Department of Health said that this, in order to comply with this amendment as it's drafted, it would require an all-payer claims database to be able to mesh this amendment with the bill, which, of course, is very expensive. So I don't think that was the maker's intention, but that's the way it's written.
With your permission, can I respond?
Sure. Go ahead, Representative.
Okay. So my intention is to include insurers. And the bottom line is when we go and we go to the doctor's office, the insurance company is kind of the third party that pays, they're supposed to pay our bills for us. And I know I just met with personnel yesterday talking about this. And they spend $1,550 for you, for every state employee every single month. It's almost $20,000 a year that we virtually pay over to Aetna, from my understanding, to cover our health care bills. And so I end up with a ton of, when I go, I don't go to the doctor that often, but when I do go to the doctor, it seems like a lot of it ends up either with deductible, out-of-pockets, non-duplicary costs, they don't do usual costs, whatever. And so this basically is much more fair. If we're trying to get true transparency with the patients of what they're going to owe at the time of the doctor's visit, then they need to know what the insurance company, and for example, he ended up talking about what Denali KidCare pays, what the military and active and retire pays, what veterans pay if they were to pay 75% of usual and customary, if they were to pay 90% of usual and customary, Medicare average. Anyway, it's just a much, if we really are trying to make this a friendly bill to the consumer, this is the step that we need to take to include to help the consumer out.
Representative Eastman, did you have a comment in connection with this issue? Go ahead.
I do. Thank you. And I don't know, but we haven't got to Amendment 1 yet. Hopefully we'll get back there. But
we will get back there today.
Very good. Amendment 1, Amendment 3 seem to be in the same direction, though, obviously taking different tacks to get there.
Representative Eastman, Amendment 1 has nothing to do with information from insurance carriers.
That is correct.
Amendment 3 is all about information from insurance carriers. I don't think you can claim that they address the same thing. They're completely different.
Well, it's my opinion that they do.
Okay, that's fine.
And as I look at getting information from insurers, it would seem to me that that would be a very important part of this whole equation. If we don't get information from insurers, and I don't see it operating quite the way that was described, if you have your health insurers who are able to get this information published online, I don't think it's your patients who are going to be going and looking at each of those things. I think just, when I go to a doctor's office or a dentist or whatnot, they're the ones that query my insurance and find that information, and they relay that information to me, and then, I work with them on whether or not I'm going to actually contract with them for those services. So I think that's much more likely the way it would go. My concern with the bill unamended is that we kind of run into the bridge too far problem. It was a great idea to go straight from Britain to Berlin in World War II by way of several bridges, but when you weren't able to actually get the last bridge, the whole idea and effort kind of crumbled because you never got there. And with as much expense and effort and cost is going to be involved in carrying this out, if we don't actually get to the point of an Alaska resident getting helpful information, which is probably going to deal with insurance, then it does seem like a whole lot of effort that's gotten us part of the way there, but then doesn't get us where we need to be.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this question, this amendment raises some good questions. I think, the health care insurance market negotiates rates for procedures individually with health care facilities and with employers. And certainly those rates are different, very different, depending on volume, probably depending on how well you manage your health care program and your history with the insurer. There can be a host of things. So if we want the insurance company to post the price that they're going to pay, it would be great if we could have an insurance company, online, or maybe somebody from a law that deals with, or a division of insurance, to say, can we do this? Can we require it? Because it will get into market proprietary information between insurance companies. And also, I see this different between requiring a healthcare facility to show some transparency, but the insurers, well, they're not here to talk, which is unfortunate, but there may be some things that we would be interfering in the market on their end by requiring them to disclose their negotiated rates for a whole host of entities, whether they were healthcare facilities or employers. And there's lots of people in this room smarter than I am on this, but that's a concern.
So I will make a couple of comments, and then we'll let Representative Ledoux or Reingold have her wind up. I had to sit on the HUS committee when they heard this bill, and the insurance companies said very little, although there were representatives there, and what they said was that there's significant privacy issues between commercial relationships between the insurance companies and their insured. So even if, for example, we had Primera here and said, what are you charging? They would say, well, we have contracts with 50 different folks, and we have different rates that we've negotiated on behalf of those different folks, and those rates are proprietary. And so I actually am really interested in knowing insurance information. I also recognize that the sponsors intend in this bill much as I believe everyone at this table would like far more transparency as to health care costs and insurance costs, the sponsor's intent with this bill was rather than try to do the global fix everything, was to try to make a very much a baby step in the world towards improved transparency. I had three people in the hall, not surprisingly, lobbyists, that some of whom represented insurance companies, to say, oh, you know, you can find exactly what your health insurance carrier pays for those procedures. Here's the number. You just call them up and they'll tell you. And I thought to myself, well, that's really interesting, because I generally find it difficult to get information from the health carrier, and they're my health carrier. And so I really like what this amendment seeks, but I think in the context of this bill, it's, I mean, it's not because of a lack of good intention, but I think it goes one step too far. I also think in the specific nature of this amendment, the information that is asked to be provided is the 50 most common health care services by the insurer in the state in the previous calendar year, and the total cost to the insurer for each of those health care services. And so as I read this language, that means if one of the procedures is a complete blood count, which we know from the earlier stuff that's what is a lot of provided, this bill would not actually have them say what is the cost per complete blood count that you're paying. This bill actually says, tell us, Primera, how much did you pay in the state last year for all the complete blood counts, and give us a total number. And I would suggest that at least what this particular amendment would ask them to provide would actually, instead of letting the consumer know what was the average price for a complete blood count as paid by insurance company X over however many thousands or hundreds of people they provide insurance for, but instead it would be a total number, and the consumer would go, doesn't help me at all. So those are my challenges with the bill. I will note that Ms. Glover is on the line with regard to the question about the $150 penalty. I certainly think we could agree as a committee to make that $50 consistent with the bill and treat that as an informal amendment, and we don't have to ask Ms. Glover anything. We can make it $50 and vote on the amendment, with that being on page 2, $50 instead of $100.
I have no idea why she did that.
So why don't we just...
She did it out of her own head, not because I asked her to.
Why don't we just agree, for purposes of the amendment, we'll treat that on line 3 as $50 instead of $150. But Representative Reinbold, if you would like to do any wind-up, and then we'll vote on the amendment.
Oh, heck yeah.
I'm seeing no objection to the $50. Everybody's nodding their heads. We're fine on changing line 3 to $50. And Ms. Glover, thank you for joining in, and I'm not sure we need you now because we've answered the $50 question. Representative Reinbold in wind-up on Amendment 3.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to use your own argument against your argument. Basically, you're saying something about insurance companies, you know, not wanting to disclose their information because of proprietary information. Well, you know, a lot of doctors don't want to do that either. They don't want it to go be posted on their front door, and then the patients are getting sticker shock. It's kind of like going to Nordstrom's. I'm just going to use this as an example. You go to Nordstrom's, you get a sticker shock. I don't shop there. If I'm going to shop, I'm going to shop at Nordstrom's Rack at a 50% off sale. I'm like you are. I'm a very, and then I'll look for coupons on top of that. I'm very, when I'm shopping, I try to get the biggest discount I possibly can get. Well, that's, when you go to Nordstrom's, they might have a $500 sticker shock, and the person will go, oh my gosh, this is outrageous. Well, people then think that doctor gets that full $500, you know, and then it turns the patient against the doctor. Well, then what they don't tell you is one, some doctors have far more specialties and went through 10 or 20 more years, you know, of school or loans or whatever, and they have had to go through so many more courses than maybe somebody else. So that's one component of this. But the second thing, they may take a Medicare patient and they might get 10% of that fee. Of what's on the price on the door, and I think that we are completely missing the boat. One, if we don't have are government facilities meeting the same standards we're demanding the private sector that often have hundreds of thousands of dollars loans to pay back, but yet the public facilities they're getting fully funded by those tax dollars don't have to comply. That's very annoying to me. But second, the fact that these doctors might have a $500 fee up there but might only get $50 for their service because the insurance company has negotiated some huge deal where they're raking in hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, taking no risk. The doctors are the ones that are seeing the patient. The doctors are the ones that have the insurance. The doctors are the ones that have to deal with a follow-up. And now the insurance companies get scot-free, you know, clean. I just find this completely misguided if we don't have the insurance companies in this bill. So I think this amendment is very, very critical if what she's trying to do to truly help with the patients and with their fees that they're reimbursing. I think this is an absolute critical last bridge to get where we want to go. Excellent example, Representative Eastman. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Clerk could call the roll on amendment number 3.
Representative Ledoux?
No.
Nay. Representative Bansler?
No.
Nay. Representative Eastman?
Yay.
Yay. Representative Reinbold?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Kopp?
Yay.
Yay. Representative Chris Tompkins?
Nay.
Nay. Chair Klayman?
No.
Nay. 3 yays, 4 nays.
So amendment number 3 has failed. Representative Reinbold, amendment number 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 4.
Object, sorry.
There's an objection. Representative Reinbold, please tell us about amendment number 4.
Okay, and this is just I kind of hit on this already, so I will definitely be brief on this. But this basically, I use the example already about the Nordstrom's example about the $500 coat, and the doctor might only get $50 or maybe even write off the whole thing, depending on if he's going to do complementary care. But it basically just means the amount the provider actually receives. I think that information is very, very important so people don't think that doctors are multimillionaires, but a lot of them have hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of medical loans to pay back and high insurance costs, and the insurance companies treat them horrendously. I know. I did this business for years, running a business office management and also even with Anchorage Fracture and Orthopedic, doing their veterans and their Medicaid and their Medicare and their TRICARE, and I can't tell you how the sticker shock looks really, really big, but what they actually get sometimes is much, much smaller. So this just basically says that the amount that they actually received for their procedure.
Thank you, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I find it very hard to argue against what you're trying to do here. It would seem to me that doctors would want the opportunity to explain that's not the amount that they're actually getting. And we all recognize that, you know, when we're talking rack rakes, I think it's universally accepted that in the majority of times, the vast majority, that rack rate is not what is actually being received by a doctor. In fact, it's probably not even being charged to the patient or the insurance. So this does get us a lot closer to actual transparency, and I think I will support this. And it also seems to me that when you have all doctors required to do this, then you also have all doctors who have the freedom to do it, because obviously, you know, you could say, hey, there's some proprietary things going on, but when you set everyone on an even playing field, then now it's not, you know, a doctor that I'm looking to do business with or healthcare provider, you know, telling me that, well, you know, this price here isn't really the price and this other price, you know, might be more accurate. But then you're kind of wondering, well, is that accurate or do they just tell that to everybody? But when you actually do say it, you know, state it that it does have to be provided by all doctors, I think that there's consistency and equity there.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux.
Well, again, I'm sympathetic to what this amendment is trying to do. But if we're really concerned about the impact of this on the private sector, then I'm hesitant about asking the doctors to provide on their list what every single insurance company is, or Medicare or Medicaid or workers' compensation is going to pay. And I guess in response to Representative Eastman's argument that doctors would like the chance to explain, when they're in the offices with any individual patient and they know what that patient's insurance is, then they certainly have that opportunity to explain. And any physician who wants to put all of those rates up, if they want that opportunity, there's nothing in this bill that prohibits them from doing so without this amendment.
Thank you. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. And amendments number 4 and 3 seem to approach this healthcare price transparency from the sort of insurance side of the equation, I suppose the provider side of the equation. And I would agree with you, Representative Reingold, and it seems like there's broad sentiment that it's really important to approach it in both directions. That said, this bill seems fundamentally a provider-based approach, and if we had another vehicle that was maybe more of an insurance-based approach, I would be very interested in having these conversations on both Amendment 3 and Amendment 4. That's it. I mean, Amendment 4 is elegant in its simplicity, but the piece I struggle with, as Representative Ledoux pointed out, if this were Nordstrom Rack, with different insurers, you have different coupons for different amounts off. Premera might be getting 60% off. Aetna might be getting 20%
exactly.
off. And so I think that gets at part of the kind of dysfunction and insanity of healthcare right now, is that you have no idea how much anything costs. And I like that this amendment tries to get at it. So I guess my one comment, one question, I'm not sure this is the right vehicle because it's more of a provider-based bill, but my question is, with amendment number 4, how would a provider know what to receive? Because, quote, and the amount the provider actually received, well, they're going to receive 10 different amounts from 10 different insurers, and I'm wondering how you foresee that being implemented in practice.
Can I?
It's a question. Yeah, that was a question for the mover of the amendment. Go
okay.
ahead, Representative Reingold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, if this is a provider-based bill, I can guarantee you most providers hate this bill. I mean, every single one that I've talked to doesn't like this bill. So this is not really what I think is coming from a great place. I actually have immense respect for the carrier of this bill. And I think it's coming from a fabulous place. I genuinely do. But I think this is not the right way to do it. And I think this is not for providers. I think it's just going to make the patients freak out, you know, when they see the sticker shock. I also think that what she said about, oh, well, they have nothing's going to prohibit them. Well, they may not want to say, oh, a Medicare patient's only going to get $50 and a veteran, you know, I'm going to charge $55 for, and then you're a rich guy, you know, that might, you know, work for, you know, a lawyer, and so I'm going to charge you $200, you know, it's just, they're not going to sit there and want to talk to that about where are you hurting? Where are you hurting? What emotional issues are you going through? How can I help you? What kind of medicine are you having? They don't really want to get into this price fixing, this antitrust, this movement toward. I think there's other. This is a much bigger issue, like with Stark laws and antitrust laws, and you know, all sorts of other things that I haven't had time to research yet, but I'm certainly going to. But that's what bothers me in regards to this. So I personally think even with this amendment, it's none of our business. It is. I have a hard time with my own amendment. It's none of our business what the insurance pays that doctor. It's a private sector doctor doing private business in his private room, and I don't even like this amendment, but I'm trying to make a point with the amendment that the sticker shock of $500, he might get, or she, many, many awesome female doctors, might only get $50. That was my point, my intent. That's why I'm not going to withdraw the amendment, because I think the intention is still there, but it was just for... If it's truly for the patient, you know, the patient might need to know that the doctor had to take a $450 cut off that $500 sticker shock. That was the point.
Follow-up, Representative Christ Tompkins. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Currently, the bill states the discounted price charged, and then this amendment would add, in addition to the undiscounted price charged, the amount the provider receives. I hope we're not worried about having too much transparency, because that's kind of what this amendment is starting to sound like. It's for those who are opposed to this, you know, it's kind of like we don't have enough transparency, but wait, that gives us too much transparency. I think too much transparency, while not always, you know, ideal in every single situation, i.e. classified military documents, but those few exceptions aside, I think transparency is a very good thing. I'm aware, and unfortunately have the dubious distinction of having a medical facility in my area, which they have a history of being on the high side. But now that information is available, it gives me and others the opportunity to talk with them about why. Why are those prices as high as they are? And you can have that conversation. And I fully expect that, you know, once the price schemes come to light between insurers and doctors and so forth, I think they're going to change. And isn't that what this is all about? Because if the prices stayed the same, what's the point of having the bill in the first place? I think we want the information out there because that's a helpful way of starting that conversation, getting that conversation, you know, kicked into high gear so that 10 years from now we're not looking at the same problem.
Thank you, Representative Eastman.
Representative Kopp. Just comment, you know, on how this works, because I think it helps paint the picture for all of us on this amendment, is a couple of years ago I picked up the front end of my riverboat. It was full of water because it had rained to set it back up on its wheel, which it folded under on the trailer, and I threw my little lower back out because I was dumb, lifted way too much weight. So went to go see the chiropractor. He said, "Are you going to self-pay?"
Or? Stronger than you are.
Yeah, well, I lifted it up, but later I realized I was dumb. So I said, "I'll self-pay." And I tell him, "He really want me to self-pay." He said, "Well, don't you have insurance?" I said, "I had to have insurance." And so anyway, it was $80 if I self-paid. And I asked him, I said, "Well, what do you get if I just, my insurance?" He said, "Well, it's $260. $260 is what we bill. That's the procedure cost. But it's 80 if you self-pay." Well, I was irritated because of the difference. I said, "I'm going to self-pay." And I could have got away with the $40 copay, but I just self-paid. And I think that Representative Reinpold's amendment just gets right at this, that if we're really looking at transparency in the marketplace, at some point we have to recognize that there is a business relationship that is not inherently evil or nefarious or there's anything wrong with it. But we have a third-party payer system with insurance companies. And since that's the system we have, we're not directly paying physicians. And if our goal is transparency, to try to get at that without including an insurer in any way does make it harder to get there. So I will support the amendment, but I realize it's problematic.
All right. I don't see anything else. I'll note I'm not supporting the amendment, but in wrap-up, Representative Reinbold.
I think Representative Kopp did a good job. I'm just going to stick with that. Thank you.
Okay, that's the push the green button.
Yes.
Okay, if we could call the roll as amendment number 4.
Do you maintain your objection?
Yes.
I said good.
Representative Price-Tompkins?
No.
Nay. Representative Ledoux?
No.
Nay. Representative Bansler?
No.
Nay. Representative Eastman?
Yay.
Yay. Representative Reinbold?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Kopp?
Yay.
Yay. Chair Klayman?
No.
3 yays, 4 nays.
Right. That brings us to amendment number 1, but I note that it is now 3:12. I am more than happy to push on for about another 15 minutes and try to get through amendment number 1 and move the bill, but I also recognize that committee members may have schedules that we have to accommodate. Representative Reinbold.
I am so sorry. I'm supposed to be over at the State Board of Education at 3 o'clock, and I'm supposed to be over in Senate Finance at 3:30, so I'm going to have to leave.
We have other
scheduling conflicts?
I'm good to be here, and I will be withdrawing Amendment Number 1, but I want to make brief comments, speaking of my dialogue with the bill sponsor. But I'm also good to move the bill today.
Well, if he's withdrawing Amendment Number 1, then I think we should just go ahead and proceed. Since if Number 1 is not being moved, then I think we can finish today. Representative Christ-Tompkins, why don't you give us a couple minutes about amendment number, about the reasons why you're not moving forward with amendment number one, and then we can roll on.
Thank you, Chair Klayman. So I felt a little bit not having the benefit of full information, considering the bill, not having seen what the actual CPT codes would be in a facility until Monday, and which after seeing that list, realize that a lot of the CPT codes are diagnostic and testing in nature, and none of the sort of meat and potatoes procedures that I think we're frequently interested in. Representative Eastman has a great restaurant analogy. Actually make the top 50. It's blood tests and it's cultures and all of this, which makes a lot of sense. And after reviewing a workers' comp medical fee schedule, which included all the meat and potatoes procedures, so to speak, MRIs, X-rays, stitches for a laceration, wondered, you know, how is there maybe a way that maintains the simplicity of the bill that integrates all of that in, and drafted Amendment Number 1 kind of blindly, hoping, thinking that it might get us there. Ashna, a representative which is in the room, worked very closely with our office to provide a list of the top 10 grossing procedures at a sample facility. I also got another top 10 grossing list from another facility. And mind you, this is facilities, not individual providers. And there was 100% overlap between the top 10 grossing procedures and the top 50 most common procedures at a facility. So Amendment Number 1 is redundant. However, I think there is a way to get there. We don't have time today. Today is not the day, or at least another direction, and that relates to the materials I passed out to every member of the committee, which is using NCCI data, which comes from workers' compensation, and it looks at the top 10 grossing procedures within different AMA service categories, and the four largest AMA service categories in healthcare are surgery at 31% of all healthcare costs, physical medicine at 29%, radiology or evaluation and management 16%, radiology at 13%. And if you get those four AMA service areas, you account for the preponderance of medical cost. So today's not the day, but I did feel it was important to put that on the record that, you know, maybe there is a way to get at these sort of meat and potatoes procedures while still working within the, I think, important parameters of simplicity in this legislation, but I know this conversation is going to continue, so I'm comfortable withdrawing the amendment and appreciate the indulgence of the chair and the sponsor.
Thank you very much. That brings the bill back before the committee with no amendments. Any further comments or discussion from members of the committee? Representative Eastman.
Yes, I'm... welcoming of the comments a moment ago, and hopeful that there's a solution to be had. That said, we don't have that solution yet, and so I'm not able to support the bill at this time. I'm looking at a long list of things that I've seen our state do with the best of intentions, which haven't accomplished those intentions, and of course I only know a small bit of our legislative history that I'm aware of. I'm sure there's a much longer list out there. As I look at how to get from where we are to a more transparent system, which I think hopefully would also mean more economical pricing and arrangements dealing with the cost of delivering health care, I don't see that this gets us there. I think this gets us somewhere. But as I pull out my Boy Scout compass, it does not seem clear to me that this gets us necessarily closer to where we want to be. And with that being the case, it actually may be pulling us to whatever degree that we do move with this bill farther away from where we want to be. We are certainly imposing more government regulations, but I don't know that that necessarily means we're getting to where we want to be. We're now, you know, instituting threat of fines on healthcare facilities, you know, $50 a day for each day after the deadline that they don't provide this information. And we also haven't solved the disparity between what we are expecting of our state facilities and our state departments and what we're asking of the private sector. And one example that stood out to me right away, and it didn't come up in amendments because none of the amendments dealt with it, but, you know, here we are making an effective date of this bill, you know, January 1st, if it passes. And so on January 1st, we now institute these requirements for our healthcare facilities. And then, you know, we say we're going to, you know, total penalties not to exceed $2,500, $50 a day, so forth. But when we read the fiscal note, we have a department that's not even going to have the regulations in place for them to upend their, to uphold their end of the bargain until July 1st of 2019. More than 2 years from now. So we're telling our private sector, hey, January 1st, start. We want you to start moving. And yet our expectation right now from our own State Department is they're not even going to have the regulations in place for them to collect that information from those healthcare facilities for more than 2 years. And I know there's any number of reasons why our expectations of our state bureaucracy are so low. But I don't think by maintaining those expectations we get us anywhere closer to either transparency or better delivered health care. So I'll be a no vote.
Any further comments from members of the committee? Can't tell Representative Reinbold whether you're putting your pen up to speak or not. Go ahead, Representative Reinbold. Yeah, it looked like you weren't heard, that's all.
Okay.
I know where you are on the bill, but I...
Well, I think I think the bill comes from an amazing place. I really do. I think that we're trying to solve a critical... We have a $2.7 billion health and social services budget, and that doesn't even touch the billions of dollars we spend in healthcare. So I think we need to do something with healthcare. There's absolutely no doubt. And without a doubt, knowing this, the Representative Bonholz, this is coming from a fabulous place. But I'm going to switch to my philosophies. And basically, I think the government has already had a massive assault on health care with the Affordable Care Act driving costs up. It's done exactly opposite of what it was intended to do in many, many cases. And then we had this $55 million bailout that we had to do, and then I think we just did another one, but we did it over a five-year period where it's costing the state. We're using a lot of our very precious state resources. Now we're taking food likely off the... through an income tax and taking permanent fund to pay for this $55 bailout, you know, from the Affordable Care Act. And it's just driving a bunch of costs up. So basically what my point is that I believe that this is going to have some very negative consequences, unintended, very, very unintended negative consequences where it's turning the patient against the doctor because of fees. And so a patient may walk. When they see a fee, they may just walk rather than looking at the quality of that the patient, the outcomes of that, that they may get from that doctor, the 20 years experience they may have in a field, the doctor, because your patient may just walk because of the fees that they see, and it's sad to me to think that patients may turn away. I also think it's a double standard that we're asking the private sector with, you know, to post these, and we're not expecting all public facilities. I think that's outlandish. I also think that we're missing the boat. Absolutely, if we don't have insurance companies, if the intention, if we're going to go and munger our fingers all and try to, you know, manipulate the free market by government mandates, you know, the bottom line is we need to have a similar standard for everybody and make sure the insurance companies, which are the key third-party payer, they have to be part of this government solution, which I'm not sure is ever really a solution. Also, I think probably one of the major reasons why I am very concerned with this bill is, let's say there's an abortion provider. I'm going to go with a hot topic. Okay, let's talk about abortion. So they're going to collect a certain fee to take the life of a baby. So basically, now that provider has to go say that's their top CPT code and they charge $500 to take the life of that baby. Maybe that doctor doesn't want the whole public to know that. Maybe that's private. I think this violates a doctor's privacy and also the privacy. I think it could cause price fixing. I've heard from three or four doctors. I sent this to about 12 doctors. They think this has a severe chance of price fixing in this state. And finally, in closing comments, I am a passionate believer in Article 1, Section 22 of our Constitution that said that it's the legislature's job to not infringe on privacy of our citizens, and I think this may be on the verge of that. Even though it comes from a very good place, I'm concerned that we're asking our doctors to, you know, publicly post on state websites private fees. So with that, I'm sadly going to be a no.
Any further comment? I don't see any further comments. I have a motion.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move version 30-LS0380/I of House Bill 123 with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there objection to moving the bill?
Objection.
Okay, we can take a roll call.
Yes. Representative Cox?
I have no objection to moving the bill, so that would be yes.
Yes, we want to move.
Yes.
Still get to make your individual recommendation.
The yay or nay, sometimes it's hard to know. We're just moving the bill. Yay.
Representative Price-Tonkins?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Fansler?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Eastman?
No.
Yay. Representative Reinbold?
No.
Yay. Chair Klayman?
Yes.
Yay. 5 yays, 2 nays.
So the bill will move by a vote of 5-2, and if you'll stay long enough to fill in the sheet. We will now adjourn for the day, and our next meeting is scheduled for Friday, March 31st at 1 p.m. On Friday, we will hold a confirmation hearing to review the qualifications of two additional appointees to the Select Commission on Legislative Ethics. We will also hear House Bill 79, Omnibus Workers' Compensation, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor. And a reminder that we will be hearing House Bill 43, on Monday, and the intent will be to move that bill on Monday. If anyone is considering offering amendments to House Bill 43, please submit them to my office by 5 p.m. on Friday. And with that, we will stand adjourned today at 3:24 p.m.